on them. But with the booster they already had, they could fire a Soyuz with one or two cosmonauts aboard on a trip around the moon. From the beginning, without warning, the Soviets had upstaged the United States in space with their own spectacular firsts. In 1957, it had been the first Earth satellite, Sputnik 1. More than 3 years later, it was Yuri Gagarin's one-orbit flight that stunned the world and sparked John Kennedy's decision to go to the moon. Then came the first woman in space, the first multi-person space crew, the first spacewalk. If the Soviets got to the moon first, even if they did nothing more than loop around it, the world would hardly notice the difference between that accomplishment and NASA's more difficult lunar orbit mission. There is no way of knowing what would have happened to Lowe's plan if NASA Administrator James Webb had been in Washington. But the fact was, he was not. He and his deputy, George Mueller, were in Vienna attending a conference. In their absence, Associate Administrator Thomas Paine, a bright young engineer with a penchant for the visionary, was in charge. When Paine's deputy, Apollo Program Director Sam Phillips, told him about Lowe's idea, Paine immediately saw the logic in it. But it remained to convince Webb, and that might not be easy. Webb was not an engineer. He was, however, a canny bulldog of a politician. When Kennedy said, "Go to the moon," it was up to Webb to keep Congress from having second thoughts, which he did by any means of persuasion he found necessary, including a knack for knowing where congressional skeletons were hidden. Year after year, he was Apollo's champion on the Hill, where it counted most. He had persevered even as the war in Vietnam claimed more and more of Lyndon Johnson's attention, and Apollo became a target of congressional opposition. If Americans reached the moon by the end of the decade, it would be due in large measure to Jim Webb. But Webb would not be at NASA to see it. He already knew his tenure would end when Johnson left office. Webb took Paine's call at the American Embassy, where there was a secure phone, and then Sam Phillips got on the line. Webb wasn't ready for what he heard. He yelled over the transatlantic phone line, "Are you out of your mind?" Webb reviewed what was apparent to any sane person. They hadn't even flown a manned Apollo spacecraft. And here they were with a scheme to send the second flight to the moon, and with no lunar module. All along, the LM had been thought of as a measure of safety, a lifeboat in case something happened to disable the command ship's rocket engines. Sending the command module by itself only increased the risk of what was already a risky mission. With the fire still fresh in the memory of the public and the Congress, Webb could only imagine the effect of another space tragedy. He warned his two deputies, "You're putting the agency and the whole program at risk." Webb was right. For all its logic, Lowe's plan was audacious. Many would look back on it as the boldest decision NASA ever made. Still, by the time Paine and Phillips hung up the phone to Vienna, Webb had agreed to give the idea a chance. In Houston, they were already working on it. Lowe had asked Chris Kraft, director of flight operations, to find out whether his people could be ready to send Apollo 8 to the moon in December. They went ahead with their study in secret. When their office mates asked, "What's all this lunar stuff you're working on?" they replied coolly, "Oh, it's just a what-if type of study." Within a week, Kraft's team had an answer. By the summer of 1968, after years of intensive effort, the basics of sending a manned spacecraft to the moon were all but perfected. The biggest hurdle? Finishing the computer software that Mission Control would need to help Apollo 8 navigate to and from the moon. Making the December launch date would be tight, but Kraft's people were confident they could do it. Meanwhile, at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, Wernher von Braun's rocket team reported the problems with the Saturn V were being ironed out. It remained for the Apollo spacecraft to prove itself. If all went well on Apollo 7, slated for October, there wouldn't be anything to stand in the way. Saturday, August 10th, 1968, North American Aviation, Downey, California. It wasn't unusual for Frank Borman to be working on Saturday. The past 19 months had been among the busiest of his life. After the fire, he had plunged into the recovery effort, beginning with the accident review board at the Cape and then many long months here at the North American plant in Downey, California. Until a few months ago, Borman had all but lived here at the factory, helping to redesign the command module. Now that effort was behind him, and the Block II command module was on the assembly line, with several of the cone-shaped craft taking form in the sterile whiteness of North American's clean room. One of those spacecraft, Command Module Number 104, the official designation for the fourth Block II command module, was his. There were problems with 104, but that was to be expected, and Borman was here with his crew, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders, to nurse his ship along and help ready it for delivery to Cape Kennedy. When Frank Borman walked into a room, you knew that he was in charge. Looking at him, he was a sturdy man with a square, slightly oversized head. You could still see a tough, scrappy kid. He'd been molded at West Point. At age 40, he still wore his dirty blonde hair as short as a cadet's, and he still lived by the Point's simple motto, duty, honor, country. The mission came first. It was always that simple for Borman. When he applied for the second astronaut group, the psychologists on the selection board said in amazement, "Nobody's that uncomplicated." He did not deal in nuance. He did not make small talk. His hearing in one ear had been bad ever since he ruptured an eardrum early in his Air Force career, but there were times when he seemed not to hear very well with the other one. In meetings, he'd listen to a number of views and then make a decision as if no one had spoken. When it came to his crew, Borman was a model of the old-school military commander. If there was a decision to be made, Borman made it. Then he told his crew about it. He hated few things more than wasting time. During meetings, if he got bored or too impatient, he would get up and walk out. He made decisions quickly, so fast that if you didn't know Borman, you would have thought him impulsive. And once he convinced himself he would do something a certain way, it was all but impossible to dissuade him, but he was usually right. And if he seemed mostly gruff and unyielding, Borman understood people, and in addition to his talents as a pilot and engineer, he was a capable manager. He was also a favorite of the NASA management. After Borman had finished his work on the accident board, and after appearing before Congress to say, "Let's stop the witch hunt and get on with it," Bob Gilruth, the head of the Manned Spacecraft Center, personally asked him to oversee the recovery efforts at North American. Borman would always look back on that time, working with the engineers here in Downey, as the most productive episode of his astronaut career. Getting Block II ready took much longer than people expected, but it was a superb spacecraft, free of most of the problems of its predecessor. It had a new, one-piece hatch that could be opened in as little as 3 seconds. It was fireproof, and soon it would be spaceworthy. And now that Block II was on the assembly line, what Borman wanted most of all was to vindicate that spacecraft. He wanted to fly it. Borman had his own command module and his own crew, but he wasn't very enthusiastic about his mission. Deke Slayton had given him command of the third manned Apollo flight, scheduled for sometime early in 1969. Eventually, it would be called Apollo 9, but for now it was known by its letter designation, the E mission. True, Borman's crew would be the first to ride the huge Saturn V booster, and during the mission they would change the high point of their orbit to a record 4,000 miles. For a few days, while they traveled that lofty ellipse, they would see the entire Earth at a glance. But aside from those frills, the E mission was a repeat of the previous flight, which belonged to Jim McDivitt. McDivitt's D mission would be the first manned test of the entire Apollo spacecraft in Earth orbit. It would include tests of the rocket engines on both the command ship and the lunar lander, and the first Apollo rendezvous maneuvers. With all those firsts, the D mission was a test piloting bonanza, and Borman would have gladly traded places with McDivitt. But this wasn't the first time Frank Borman was going to fly a mission he did not want. In December 1965, after waiting 3 years for his chance to fly in space, Borman lifted off on what was considered the dregs mission of the Gemini series, Gemini 7, a 2-week marathon in Earth orbit. Borman and his co-pilot, Jim Lovell, spent 14 days in Gemini 7's tiny cabin, wired from stem to stern with medical sensors. 2 weeks in a flying men's room, it wasn't an enviable assignment, but Borman took it without complaint. Dregs or no, he wanted to fly, and in his mind he'd accepted whatever assignments might come his way on the day he joined the astronaut corps, including the E mission. On Saturday, August 10th, Borman was knee-deep in testing command module 104 when he was called away for a phone call from Deke Slayton. "Frank, get back to Houston right away. I need to talk to you," Slayton said. "So talk to me now, Deke. I'm busy. I can't do this over the phone. Grab an airplane and get back here." Borman was irritated at the interruption. The test was far from over, but when he reached Slayton's office and his boss asked him to close the door, he understood the urgency. Borman listened as Slayton described the CIA report on the Soviets and George Lowe's plan to send Apollo 8 to the moon. Borman immediately saw the logic. A successful lunar orbit mission would lift NASA out of the shadow of the fire, restore its shaken confidence, propel it to a lunar landing. Slayton was proposing that Borman and McDivitt swap places and command modules, that Borman's crew fly in December. One thing Slayton did not say was that he had already offered the lunar mission to Jim McDivitt, who had turned it down. As for himself and his crew, Borman needed no time to weigh his decision. To him, Apollo was like a war. Nothing less than the nation's prestige was at stake. He wanted to see the war won. When Slayton asked him if he wanted to go to the moon, Borman said yes. Monday, August 12th, Timber Cove, Texas. Marilyn Lovell was feeling pleased with herself. She had just finished a long, hot day of hunting for bargains on vacation clothing in the August department store sales. She could barely remember the last time the family had taken a vacation. Was it before Jim became an astronaut? But just a few weeks ago, Jim had agreed to take the family to Acapulco during his week off between Christmas and New Year's. Marilyn was jubilant. And today, in the Houston swelter, she'd found some great buys. She would tell her news to Jim, who would be home tonight from a trip to California. Marilyn and Jim had met and dated in the mid-1940s when they were both attending high school in Milwaukee. Even then, Jim had his mind on the stars. Sometimes, on clear nights, he would take her to the roof of his apartment building to give her a tour of the heavens. And during World War II, Jim had been fascinated by the reports of German V-2 rockets. Marilyn witnessed his experiments with rockets made from mailing tubes and fueled by gunpowder mixed with airplane glue. While he and a classmate were busy in the open field across the street, Marilyn would sit in the apartment with Jim's mother, both of them hoping the two boys didn't blow their heads off. But this was no reckless stunt. The young experimenters took every precaution, wearing welder's goggles and gloves, and it was a good thing. One rocket exploded, sending the nose cone about 80 feet into the air. No one was injured. In fact, Jim proudly proclaimed the flight a qualified success. After high school, Jim went to Annapolis, where he had his sights on becoming a rocket engineer. For his senior thesis, he wrote about interplanetary rocket travel, and Marilyn, now his fiancée, typed the paper for him. When she came to the end, she read with disbelief Jim's statement that someday people might ride rockets to the moon. But in 1952, there weren't any jobs for rocket engineers to speak of, and after Annapolis, Jim found himself flying airplanes for the Navy. His life had taken a different path, and to Marilyn's joy and amazement, it had led to Houston and into space. Like all the astronaut wives, Marilyn accepted the constant demands the space program placed on her marriage. Her husband's competition for flights spilled over into her own life, just as it did with all the wives. In 1965, while Jim was training for his first Gemini mission, Marilyn discovered she was pregnant with their fourth child. She kept the news to herself for weeks because she was afraid Jim might be taken off the crew. And for the next 3.5 years, as Jim plunged happily into the maw of training, going from backup crew to prime crew to backup and prime again, Marilyn was head of the household, financial manager, mother and father to their kids. During the week, Jim would always call in from wherever he was, and somehow they managed to work through the day-to-day crises over the phone. But seeing him in person, that was something she enjoyed only on weekends. Now Jim was working with Frank Borman again, and his lunar module pilot, Bill Anders. But with the flight set for late next winter, the most intensive training was still ahead, and Marilyn was glad that her husband had finally made plans to take some time off at the end of the year. When Jim came home, Marilyn proudly reported the success of the day's shopping expedition. In the midst of her excitement, she noticed Jim had a peculiar expression, and when she asked him what was wrong, he took her into the privacy of his study, where pictures from his space flights adorned dark wood paneling, and closed the door. "I hate to tell you this," he said, "but we're not going to Acapulco for Christmas." Marilyn didn't try to hide her disappointment.
"What do you mean we're not going? Where on earth do you think you're going to be if you're not going to be with the family for Christmas?"
Years later, Marilyn would still get goosebumps thinking about what happened next. Jim paused for just a moment, his eyes bright, and he said, "Would you believe the moon?" Some people, other astronauts, had the mistaken impression that Jim Lovell flew through life on luck. Tall, relaxed, and outgoing, Lovell got along with everybody. Frank Borman would later say that he had never worked with anyone who faced life with such consistent, good-natured optimism. But Lovell's easygoing manner masked his competitive energy and sharp mind. He'd graduated first in his test pilot class at Patuxent River, ahead of Wally Schirra and Pete Conrad. Like Conrad, he had been turned down for the Mercury selection, then made it with the second astronaut group. Lovell had to wonder at the twist of fate that had brought him and Frank Borman together again. Lovell knew Borman well. After 2 weeks cooped up in Gemini 7, he probably knew him better than anyone except his wife. The two men were the same age. Lovell was 11 days younger, and although they had chosen different branches of the service, Borman the Air Force, Lovell the Navy, they were the same equivalent rank. In Lovell's mind, they had been equally qualified to command a space mission. When Slayton named him as Borman's co-pilot on Gemini 7, Lovell took the assignment without ever revealing his disappointment. He was a rookie, and he wanted to fly. 2 weeks in space only whet Lovell's appetite for more, but Slayton handed him a dead-end assignment as backup commander for the final Gemini mission. That changed when Elliot Sea and Charlie Bassett were killed. Lovell and Buzz Aldrin reached orbit for Gemini's finale. Lovell expected to move into Apollo with his own crew, but instead found himself as backup command module pilot for Frank Borman's E mission. But in July, fate again changed Jim Lovell's plans. Borman's command module pilot, Mike Collins, was forced off the crew by a bone spur on his spine that threatened his body and his career. Collins would have corrective surgery, but even if it went perfectly, he would be out of action for months. Lovell stepped in to take his place, and now he found himself flying right seat to Borman once more. When Borman came back from Houston with the news that they were going to the moon, Lovell was electrified. He could still remember how, as a boy, he had devoured such science fiction classics as Jules Verne's From the Earth to the Moon, in which a trio of adventurers ride a craft fired out of an enormous cannon on a circumlunar voyage. It had been beyond his wildest teenage dreams that he might see human beings live out the adventure Jules Verne had imagined, let alone that he would be one of them. Even now, as an astronaut who had made the moon his goal, he found the news almost too exciting to believe. Later, under the clear canopy of a T-38, as he and Borman flew back to Houston, he had sketched a design on his knee pad that would become the mission emblem of Apollo 8, a figure 8 with the Earth in one loop and the moon in the other. Lovell never had any second thoughts about the lunar mission. To him, it was worth the risk for the adventure alone, never mind the potential for scientific discovery, and then, to be pathfinders for those who would follow, the benefits Apollo 8 would bring to the program, who could question the logic of it? Once Lovell had a chance to get used to the idea, he wondered why that hadn't been the plan all along. In the summer of 1968, Bill Anders's fortunes seemed to be improving all the time. He had spent much of the spring as one of a handful of astronauts who were learning how to fly the dangerous and unwieldy trainer called the Lunar Landing Research Vehicle. Neil Armstrong was flying it too, and he and Anders had a friendly competition to see who could make the better simulated lunar touchdown. No one had said, "This means you're in line for a landing mission," but you didn't get an assignment like that for no reason. Meanwhile, he was hard at work as Frank Borman's lunar module pilot for the E mission. As a lunar module pilot, he was developing an intimate knowledge of the lander, and the experience he'd get on the E-mission would surely make him an ideal candidate for a landing mission down the line. It looked as though Shepard and Slayton had finally recognized what he could do and were going to give him a chance to prove it. Anders figured he had an 80% chance of walking on the moon in the near future. When Frank Borman came back to Downey with the extraordinary news that their mission had been changed, Anders felt disappointment underneath his excitement. He was losing his lunar module, and with it his chance to one day land on the moon. Borman tried to give him a fatherly talk, saying it wasn't so bad, that he'd still get his chance later, but Anders wasn't convinced. The good news was he was going to the moon in 4 months. The bad news was he would probably never walk on it. With only 4 months to go until a December launch, no one had time for second-guessing, least of all Frank Borman. As mission commander, he had to be intimately involved in working out the flight plan for his mission. Normally that took months, and since the circumlunar mission was an entirely new creation, it should have taken even longer. But, to Borman's great satisfaction, he would look back on this as the space program at its best. The basic design for Apollo 8 was hammered out in a single meeting one August afternoon in the office of Chris Kraft. Christopher Columbus Kraft, Jr. was the engine that powered mission control. In the infancy of manned spaceflight, Kraft had created the persona of a flight director as an actor creates a timeless role, setting the standard for all who would follow. Now in his mid-40s, the Virginia-born Kraft possessed the special brand of grace under pressure required to direct a space mission in which human lives are at stake. To his team of flight controllers, the men who manned the trenches of mission control and kept watch on every bit of telemetry from a spaceborne machine, he was stern, generous, perceptive, and inspiring, sometimes all at once. They idolized him the way an infantry division does a beloved commander. In addition to his forthrightness, you always knew where you stood with Kraft, he had the ability to sort through differences of opinion and get to what really mattered. To Frank Borman, Kraft was one of NASA's giants. Kraft's style, honed during a score of manned and unmanned space missions, was an almost inexplicable blend of caution and boldness. Borman knew it well, for it had been Kraft who had saved Gemini 7. For Borman, the last 3 days in Earth orbit were the worst 3 days of his life. Thrusters went bad. Fuel cells were threatening to quit. They were low on maneuvering fuel. He and Lovell were just drifting around the Earth, trying to hold out long enough to fly the full 14 days. Had it been up to him, they never would have made it, because he was ready to come down. It was Kraft's persistence and deft handling of the crises that kept Borman going to complete his mission. On the afternoon of August 19th, Borman and several of Kraft's best people, including such stalwarts as Bill Tindall, the tireless and ebullient mission planner who spearheaded the effort to work out detailed techniques for all phases of the lunar landing, gathered in Kraft's office to design the first flight to the moon. The 6-day mission was slated to begin on December 21st, just after the new moon. The timing was chosen so that when Apollo 8 arrived, the sun would just be rising across the Sea of Tranquility, throwing the landscape into relief, allowing Borman's crew to reconnoiter a potential touchdown spot for the first landing. Borman's crew would become the first to ride the 3-stage Saturn V booster into space. Reaching orbit, they would leave the rocket's 3rd stage attached. For about 3 hours, while they circled the Earth twice, Borman, Lovell, and Anders would check the systems aboard their spacecraft while mission control scrutinized Apollo 8 via telemetry. A failure in any of thousands of components might prompt the controllers to cancel the lunar mission and direct Apollo 8 to stay in Earth orbit for a 10-day alternate mission. But if everything was in order, they would send Borman's crew a historic message: go for translunar injection. In that maneuver, the astronauts called it TLI, Borman's crew would relight the Saturn's 3rd stage and accelerate out of Earth orbit. When the engine shut down, Apollo 8 would cast off the spent booster and continue on a course for the moon, 240,000 miles away. From then on, Borman, Lovell, and Anders would be in uncharted territory. Consider the sheer scale of the voyage. Up to now, human beings had barely strayed from their home planet. The world's altitude record, set by Gemini 11 astronauts Pete Conrad and Dick Gordon, was a mere 850 miles. If the Earth were a basketball, that would amount to just 1 inch from the surface. But in the same scale model, the Moon, 2,160 miles in diameter, would be a baseball 23 feet away. Getting to the Moon and back would require acts of precision more demanding than any previous spaceflight. To make matters more difficult, the Moon is a moving target, barreling along in its orbit at a speed of 2,300 miles an hour. Apollo 8 would have to reach the Moon's orbit just as the Moon was arriving. Then, like a car racing a locomotive at a crossing, the spacecraft would zip in front of the Moon's leading edge. After speeding behind the Moon, Borman's crew would fire the spacecraft's main rocket engine and go into an orbit with a low point of 69 miles above the lunar surface, 0.08 of an inch from the skin of the baseball. But that was only if everything went as planned. Suppose Borman's crew suffered a serious malfunction, an engine failure, for example, before they reached the Moon. Without some other way to turn around, would they simply speed past the Moon, condemned to a lonely death when their oxygen supply ran out? Fortunately, the laws of celestial mechanics, whose strictness gave spaceflight an extraordinary predictability, made it possible to give Borman's crew a built-in ticket home. The trajectory specialists had taken advantage of this in an elegant creation called the free return. By aiming Apollo 8 at just the right distance from the Moon, they could use the lunar gravity well, like a curve in a toboggan course, to bend its path around the Moon and send it back toward Earth. In theory, it was possible to fire Apollo 8 out of the starting gate so precisely that it would fly a perfect figure eight around the Moon, even if Borman's crew never touched the controls. There wasn't a man in Kraft's trajectory division who wasn't so confident of this that he would have offered to go in their place. Borman took them at their word. He wanted the trajectory people to pledge they'd keep Apollo 8 on an essentially perfect free return path, but that was a promise they could not make. The problem, they stressed, was that it would simply not be possible to keep perfect track of Apollo 8's position in space at any given moment. There would always be some error in the measurement, but how big an error, no one could say until Apollo 8 was actually moonward bound. And without that precise knowledge, a perfect free return was impossible to guarantee. Furthermore, there was a crucial built-in safety measure. Unlike a rifle bullet, or for that matter, Jules Verne's manned cannon shell, Borman's crew would be able to correct Apollo 8's path along the way with bursts from its small maneuvering thrusters. If the spacecraft drifted off course, mission control would be able to tell, and they would radio Borman's crew instructions for a so-called mid-course correction. As long as the maneuvering thrusters were functioning, there would be plenty of chances along the way to keep Apollo 8 on course. The translunar crossing of some 234,000 miles would take 66 hours, roughly half the time it takes an ocean liner to cross the Atlantic. At last, on the morning of December 24th, Apollo 8 would reach its destination. If everything checked out on board, mission control would give Borman's crew the go-ahead for lunar orbit insertion, LOI. Over the lunar far side, out of radio contact with Earth, they would fire Apollo 8's Big Service Propulsion System, SPS, rocket engine for some 4 minutes, just long enough to slow to the speed necessary to go into lunar orbit, about 3,700 miles per hour. When the engine shut down, there would be no more free ticket home. Apollo 8 would be a satellite of the Moon, and Borman's crew would have to trust the SPS to work perfectly when the time came to return to Earth. While millions on Earth would be among friends and loved ones on Christmas Eve, Borman, Lovell, and Anders would spend it circling the Moon, taking pictures and observing its pockmarked surface at close range. From their orbiting platform, they would scout landing sites and take navigation sightings on lunar landmarks. Meanwhile, Kraft's trajectory people would track Apollo 8, amassing data on its orbit and keeping close watch for any changes. Already, from some of the unmanned lunar orbiter probes, scientists knew that the moon's gravitational pull was uneven, probably due to buried masses of relatively dense rock that they called mascons, short for mass concentrations. Mascons had caused small, unexpected shifts in the probe's orbits, and they would surely do the same thing to an Apollo spacecraft. Before anyone could commit a crew to a lunar landing mission, mascons had to be understood. But here was the makings of a dilemma. Some of Kraft's people wanted Apollo 8 to circle the moon for as long as possible to accumulate the maximum amount of data on its orbit. Frank Borman, on the other hand, didn't want to spend a minute longer in lunar orbit than necessary. The longer they stayed, the greater the chance of something going wrong. In the end, with Kraft mediating, they settled on 10 orbits, a total of 20 hours circling the moon. The first minutes of Christmas Day would bring the moment of truth for Borman's crew, the final blast from their big rocket engine called Trans-Earth Injection, TEI, to free them from the bonds of lunar gravity and send them toward a small and distant Earth. On December 27th, in the last hour of their homeward voyage, Borman's crew would cast off the spent service module and steer their command ship through one final act of precision, re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere at 25,000 miles per hour. The angle of approach would be critical. Too shallow, and the command module would bounce off the atmosphere like a stone skipping across the waters of a pond. Too steep, and it would be torn to pieces by the forces of deceleration. The zone of safety was a perilously narrow cone, just 2 degrees wide. Think once more of the Earth as a basketball. Re-entry was like trying to hit the edge of a thin sheet of cardboard balanced atop it. These were the weighty matters under discussion that afternoon in Kraft's office. The boldest venture in the history of space exploration, the safety of the three men who would make the journey. And if Borman had shown some unease, he also displayed characteristic pragmatism and bluntness. Someone anxiously pointed out that the timing for a 10-orbit mission meant Apollo 8 would splash down in darkness. "What the hell difference does it make?" asked Borman. "If the parachutes don't open, we're dead anyway, whether it's day or night." Some risks, Borman understood, weren't worth worrying about. For now, the new mission was still kept secret, even from the other astronauts. There were still too many what-ifs unanswered, the biggest being whether the command module would perform well on its maiden voyage, Apollo 7. But for Borman, Lovell, and Anders, there could be no waiting, and as the summer of 1968 neared its end, they plunged into training for the first flight around the moon. For Borman and his crew, Apollo 8 began on September 9th inside the command module simulator, a jumble of angular shapes that resembled high-tech sculpture. A carpeted stairway led to a small, square hatchway and an exact replica of the command module cabin in which every switch, readout, and control, from engine gauges to circuit breakers to hand controllers, was simulated to function like the real thing. Without ever leaving Earth, Borman's crew practiced the complex task of piloting a moonship. They confronted untried maneuvers like the lunar orbit insertion burn and the hypersonic reentry. Here is where Borman's crew earned their own self-confidence, practicing every phase of the mission from liftoff to splashdown until it became second nature. Outside, seated at consoles, were the simulation instructors, young men with sharp minds and mischievous spirits who understood the command module as well as the astronauts did, perhaps even better. Much to the chagrin of any astronaut within earshot, they liked to say that they could take any reasonably bright individual off the street and, in a year's time, teach them to fly to the moon. It would have been an empty boast if not for the command module's onboard computer. Utterly primitive by today's standards, this mid-60s vintage had only 33,000 words of memory, a fraction of any modern desktop model, but in that memory lay coded instructions for a flight to the moon, permanently written on bundles of magnetized wire encased in plastic, so that not even a total power failure would erase them. Although the computer was incapable of adding two numbers, when it came to getting to the moon and back, it was as good as putting Isaac Newton himself to work on the problem. It could calculate the command module's position and path through space with the same equations of motion used by Newton to study the orbits of celestial bodies. And it was so essential to flying the command module that the astronauts thought of it as a fourth crew member. Normally, it was the computer that would align the command module's gyroscopic navigation platform with the stars, fire its rocket engine with precision, and keep its antenna aimed at the Earth. Thanks to the computer, the spacecraft would almost fly itself. That is, if everything worked. The premise of simulation, borne out by hundreds of hours of manned space flights, was that not everything would work. Again and again, under the watchful eyes of the simulation instructors, Borman's crew rode the rumbling Saturn booster off the Earth. Before long, the instructors were throwing in simulated malfunctions, engine failures, errant trajectories, electrical trouble, and in each case the astronauts had to respond quickly and correctly. Sometimes, for example, when the Saturn strayed dangerously off course, the only thing to do was abort. Early in the launch, Borman would simply take hold of the abort handle in his left hand and twist it, setting off an automatic chain of events to fire a rocket, called the escape tower, perched on the spacecraft's nose. It would yank the command module away from the careening booster and then depart, leaving Borman's crew to a high-speed roller coaster ride through the atmosphere before parachuting into the Atlantic. But if the mishap struck later, when the escape tower was already cast off and the Saturn had propelled them to the fringes of space, Borman's crew would have to cut loose from the booster and then, racing the clock, fire up the service module's big rocket engine to kick them onto the right trajectory for a safe splashdown. Emergencies like that test the mettle of a space crew, and there were plenty of them in all phases of their simulated lunar journeys. An engine malfunction during lunar orbit insertion, communications trouble on the way home, computer failure just before re-entry. Yes, the simulation instructors would readily admit, if things went wrong, it would take a highly skilled and experienced test pilot to escape disaster. But none of them could have mastered it all, not with only 4 months to train, and so each man had to specialize. As Commander Borman had the overall mission responsibility, he also trained to steer the command module through its fiery re-entry in case the computer went out. Lovell, meanwhile, concentrated on navigation. He would use the command module's sextant to make star sightings throughout the voyage to verify the craft's trajectory. In lunar orbit, he would take bearings on lunar landmarks, and if the radio went out at any time, it would be up to Lovell to get them home, and to Bill Anders fell the role of command module systems expert. Then there was the service module, the 16-foot cylinder that would be joined to the command module's base throughout the voyage. It contained the rocket engines, propellants, oxygen, and electric power fuel cells. All of it was Anders's responsibility, and Borman had told him in no uncertain terms, "I'm expecting you to make sure it works." The first time Anders climbed into the simulator, sometime in 1967, he was greeted by an almost bewildering array of switches, dials, displays, and controls. Over time, they grew familiar, as Anders learned to navigate the miles of wiring, the intricate array of pipes, valves, tanks, antennas, relays. Subjected to one simulated malfunction after another, he came to play the spacecraft like a virtuoso. If plumbing to the big rocket engine became blocked, he rerouted the flow of propellants. When one of the power-producing fuel cells conked out, he rearranged electrical connections to keep current flowing. In time, these sessions in the simulator seemed less like spaceflight than a ride in a game box. Even when he wasn't in the simulator, Anders was learning his machine, immersing himself in a world of fuel cells and evaporators, relays and accelerometers. Seeming bits of minutiae that Borman simply didn't have time for became Anders's turf. To Borman, Anders was like a precocious younger brother, and it rankled him that the junior man sometimes knew more about the hardware than he did, especially when Anders realized why one of Borman's ideas wouldn't work. "God damn it, Anders, show me!" In his intimacy with the machine, Anders found reassurance. He couldn't help but be impressed with the beauty of the Apollo design. Nothing exemplified this better than the SPS rocket engine, rated at 20,500 pounds of thrust, that would get Borman, Lovell, and himself into and out of lunar orbit. The beauty of the SPS was its simplicity. It was a no-frills rocket engine. There were no fuel pumps, because pumps have moving parts that could break down. Instead, pressurized helium forced the propellants into the combustion chamber. It had no ignition system. None was required, because the SPS burned hypergols, in this case hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide, chemicals so reactive that they need only come in contact with each other to explode into hot gases. As long as the valves opened, that engine would fire. And for all its simplicity, the SPS was an extremely high-performance rocket engine. And the SPS also exemplified Apollo's other watchword, redundancy. The fuel tanks, pipes, valves, quantity sensors, everything except the combustion chamber and the huge engine nozzle itself came in duplicate sets. If one component malfunctioned, there was a backup standing by, but would it work? In the moment of truth, would it blast them out of lunar orbit on a course for home? Or would there be only silence? According to its designers, Apollo was 3/9 reliable. The odds of an astronaut's survival were 0.999, or only one chance in 1,000 of being killed. Anders, for one, didn't believe it. The odds couldn't possibly be that good. Soon after he found out about the lunar mission, he took time to ponder his chances of coming back from Apollo 8, and he made a mental tabulation of risk and reward in an effort to come to terms with what he was about to do. Frank Borman would never have conducted such an exercise. Danger, like speed, is an experience that follows a logarithmic, ever-shallowing curve. Once you've been exposed to a lot of risk, and Anders had been as a fighter pilot, then a hell of a lot of risk doesn't seem like that much more. So it wasn't just his own welfare that he considered. He thought of his wife, Valerie, and of their 5 young children. He had barely any life insurance. No one would sell it to an astronaut about to go to the moon. Was it irresponsible to hazard leaving them alone so prematurely? Was a seat on the first flight around the moon worth that chance? In Anders's mind, there were 3 factors. First, and most important, it was the greatest opportunity for adventure and exploration a man could have in the 20th century. He would see the hidden face of the moon with his own eyes, and he would be first. Second, as an American and as a military man, he felt a sense of duty, and Apollo was his country's most important mission. As a pilot, he could not deny Apollo 8's lure, the first manned test flight of the Saturn V, the first voyage of the Apollo spacecraft to lunar distance. Finally, Apollo 8 would put his name in the history books. Somehow, Anders couldn't say exactly why, all those things combined were worth it. If he had 2 chances in 3 of coming back, and he figured the odds were probably a good bit better than that, he was ready. As the summer ended, NASA lifted the veil of secrecy surrounding the circumlunar mission. As if to heighten the sense of urgency, the Soviets achieved a notable advance in mid-September. An unmanned spacecraft called Zond 5 flew a figure-8 loop around the moon and splashed down in the Indian Ocean, all under automatic control. This was the same type of free-return trajectory being planned for Apollo 8. Before long, many speculated, a man would follow. Meanwhile, in Houston, the flurry of activity and anticipation surrounding Apollo 8 almost eclipsed Apollo 7, the first manned Apollo flight. And yet, Apollo 7's outcome would make or break the decision for a moon flight. Everyone knew the odds were small that a craft as complex as the command module would sail through its maiden voyage with no major problems, but that is just what happened. On October 11th, Wally Schirra, Don Eisley, and Walt Cunningham rode a Saturn 1B booster into orbit for an 11-day shakedown cruise. Schirra's crew met every engineering objective and performed every scientific experiment in the flight plan, and then some. Only minor problems turned up in the command and service modules. The big SPS engine passed every test. Perhaps the biggest problem of Apollo 7 was its irascible commander. Shiraz's performances in Mercury and Gemini had won him admiration, but this time around he surprised observers by acting ornery and short-tempered. He caught a monster head cold early in the mission and sneezed and sniffled his way through the 11 days. Along the way, he battled with craft's flight controllers, canceling a scheduled television broadcast from space, then refusing to accept changes in the flight plan. At times, Shiraz's bluster seemed to rub off on his crew. After one test, Isley quipped with obvious annoyance that he wanted to talk to the man, or whoever it was that thought up that little gem. The man was Glenn Lunny, the flight director. By the time Shiraz and his crew were ready to come home, Kraft's men were so angry that one of them offered, only half-jokingly, to bring Apollo 7 down into a typhoon, and Kraft was half-ready to have him do it. Years later, Shiraz would pin his bad mood on some broken promises, including a decision to launch Apollo 7 under less-than-ideal conditions. Other astronauts felt there was no excuse. To make such outbursts with the world listening, they would say, was plain unprofessional. Cunningham would publicly surmise that the grind of training for almost a decade had simply worn the man out. But for Chris Kraft, there was another explanation for Shiraz. The fire, which had claimed his next-door neighbor Gus Grissom, had scared the daylights out of him. Discord aside, Apollo 7 was better than anyone could have hoped for. Now NASA made it official. Apollo 8 was going to the moon. Within weeks, however, the Soviets made their next move. 18 months after the Komarov tragedy, they lofted Soyuz 3 with Georgi Beregovoy aboard and returned him 4 days later. Whether another Soyuz was being readied for a circumlunar mission, no one knew. In Houston, the Space Center geared up to support Apollo 8, and at the center of it all, Frank Borman tried to keep his mission from growing beyond bounds. If someone brought up an idea that was strictly essential to the mission, Borman cut him off. It didn't matter how small the extra. Even an improved type of in-flight meal, Borman's reaction was always swift and negative. Some of his reluctance was understandable, but to Jim Lovell, his behavior seemed entirely in character. In the last days of Gemini 7, Kraft wasn't the only one who tried to keep Borman's spirits up. When Borman talked about re-entering early, Lovell encouraged him to keep going. When Borman worried they might have to come down in some remote stretch of ocean, Lovell reassured him, "The Navy would find us, Frank. They know what they're doing." Not that Borman's fretting affected his performance, but as far as Lovell could tell, behind that macho, take-charge exterior was a very apprehensive astronaut. Was Borman more uncomfortable with the lunar mission than he let on? Years later, he would say that to his mind, his worry was simple. He wanted to make sure he and his crew didn't get handed a mission they couldn't perform. He'd seen Gemini commanders accept flight plans so crowded with tests and experiments that nobody could have done them all. He was determined that wasn't going to happen to him. In Borman's mind, anything that wasn't essential to the mission, circle the moon 10 times and come home, was inviting trouble. They were going to the moon. That was enough. By late November, with a month to go until launch, Borman and his crew were working 7 days a week, spending 3 or 4 days in the simulators at the Cape, and coming back to Houston for meetings with mission planners. Now, there was no time for weekend parties or dinners with friends. Sunday existed only to wade through the piles of mail on their desks. So demanding was the pace that they had less time than they wanted for exercise, and they were a somewhat tired crew by the time LBJ threw a bon voyage party for them in Washington. As the fall of 1968 wore on, apprehension surfaced once more within NASA. Would the Soviets try to beat Apollo 8 to the moon? Due to the latitude of the Baikonur launch site in Central Asia, their lunar launch window opened in early December, well before the Americans. The week passed with no news from the Soviet Union. By the beginning of December, everyone at NASA realized, with great relief, that there would be no Soviet circumlunar attempt in 1968. The field was clear. Now it remained to send Apollo 8 on its way. On December 10th, with only 11 days to go until launch, Borman, Lovell, and Anders flew their T-38s to the Cape for the last time. From now on, they would live there, in the Spartan crew quarters. Each man had a small bedroom and shared a living room, a conference room with maps of the moon and the stars on the walls, and a dining room that was something like a ship's mess hall. The decor was strictly Holiday Inn, but there were compensations, not the least of which were the high-calorie meals served up by a former tugboat cook named Lou Hartzell, brimming with steak and potatoes and mile-high sandwiches. Access was highly restricted to protect the men from last-minute illness. The sign at the entrance to the crew quarters read, "No one with a cold or symptoms of a cold may pass beyond this point." In this comfortable monastery, the three men settled in for their last days on Earth. Occasionally, less than they would have liked, they had a chance to go for a run or to work out in the nearby exercise room. They reviewed the flight plan and received briefings on the readiness of their spacecraft and Saturn booster. And above all, there were the daily sessions in the simulator. At times, Apollo 8 seemed to be an exercise in switches and valves and maneuvers, not the first flight away from the Earth. But on December 20th, the day before launch, Borman's crew had a visitor who brought home the historic impact of what they were about to attempt. Charles Lindbergh, one of the most enigmatic figures of the 20th century, emerged from his retreat to visit Borman, Lovell, and Anders in the crew quarters. 41 years after flying solo across the Atlantic, Lindbergh appeared tall, tanned, and surprisingly fit for his 66 years. Accompanied by his wife, Anne, herself an accomplished pilot and author, Lindbergh arrived to have lunch with three fellow flyers about to navigate an ocean far more vast and untraveled. To most of the astronauts, Lindbergh had been a boyhood hero, and Borman was no exception. Now, in the quiet of the crew quarters, it was just one flyer talking to other flyers. Gathered around the table with Lindbergh and his wife, Borman's crew and their backups shared questions, recollections, and humor. They were fascinated by his accounts of meetings with Robert Goddard, whose experiments with liquid-fueled rockets in the New Mexico desert had foretold the space age and fired the imagination of a teenage Jim Lovell. Goddard had conceived of flights to the moon, Lindbergh said, but was daunted by the fantastic cost of the venture. He had mused, "It might cost $1 million." With that, the room exploded in laughter. The great flyer asked Borman's crew about the navigation system that would take them to the moon. Then he told the astronauts how, before his own trip, he and a friend had gone to the library, found a globe, and measured, with a piece of string, the distance from New York to Paris. From that, he had figured out how much fuel he would need for the flight. Lindbergh asked how much fuel the Saturn V rocket would consume during its climb into space. One of the astronauts did a quick calculation, 20 tons per second. Lindbergh smiled. "In the first second of your flight tomorrow," he said, "you'll burn 10 times more fuel than I did all the way to Paris." 8 miles away, the Saturn V towered above Pad 39A, looking more like a skyscraper than a rocket, some 363 feet tall, about 6 stories higher than the Statue of Liberty. The Saturn was more than 3 times the size of the Titan missile Borman and Lovell rode in Gemini 7. It was, far and away, the most powerful thrust machine ever flown, the crowning achievement of Wernher von Braun and his team of rocket engineers at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Through it, the sheer difficulty of reaching the moon was made visible. It was a monument to human audacity. For now, the Saturn stood empty. But overnight, even while Borman's crew slept, technicians would ready it for departure. By morning, its enormous fuel tanks would be filled with super-cold propellants until the rocket would contain the explosive energy of an atomic bomb. This engineering masterpiece was designed to tame that energy and liberate it in a sustained, fiery release of power. Public relations people for the contractors that built the Saturn were always coming up with new analogies to convey its incredible might. Someone estimated that the thrust from the booster's first stage engines at liftoff would equal more than twice the hydroelectric power that would be obtained if all the rivers and streams in North America were channeled through turbines. Everything about the Saturn V was grossly out of scale with the rest of the world. For example, each of the five F1 engines that powered the first stage had an engine bell measuring 12 feet in diameter. At liftoff, those engines would deliver a combined thrust of 7.5 million pounds, about 160 million horsepower. Three separate stages would do the work of pushing Apollo 8 off the Earth and toward the Moon. The first stage alone, nearly half a football field long, would burn 500,000 gallons of kerosene and liquid oxygen in just 2.5 minutes, cutting off at a height of 40 miles, and then it would fall away. The second stage would fire for just over 6 minutes until its supply of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen was spent. By then, Borman's crew would be 120 miles up, and all that would remain would be a 3-minute push from the third stage to place Apollo 8 in orbit around the Earth. The third stage would do its best work 3 hours later, when Borman's crew would execute the translunar injection maneuver to break the bonds of their home planet. For now, the Saturn stood in the embrace of its steel launch tower, waiting for the launch window to the Moon to open. Evening twilight revealed the Moon's thin crescent glowing briefly in the west. Anders went out in the parking lot with a couple of visitors to look at it, then slipping beneath the horizon of a turning Earth. At nightfall, the floodlights at Pad 39A came on, turning the Saturn into a huge glowing monument and reaching past it into the Florida night. In the crew quarters, Frank Borman lay awake in his room, confronting his darkest fear. It wasn't blowing up on the Saturn, being stranded in lunar orbit, or being burned to a cinder in re-entry. Some people had wanted him to make a tape in case he didn't come back. He'd scoffed at the idea. Sure, he had some anxiety. Who wouldn't have, preparing to go to the Moon for the first time? But if he thought he wasn't coming back, he wouldn't be going. Borman was afraid of one thing, that they would be in Earth orbit and some malfunction, however small, would arise, and the managers in Houston would cancel the lunar mission right there. He would be stuck with the alternate mission, 10 long days in Earth orbit doing nothing but keeping the spacecraft going. He hated the thought of it. And as the night dragged on, while technicians worked under the floodlights of Pad 39A, readying his booster for an early morning launch, Borman prayed not that he would come back from the Moon, but that he would have the chance to go. 2. A Hole in the Stars. Saturday, December 21st, 1968. Frank Borman's sleepless night came to an end at a few minutes past 2:30 a.m. when Deke Slayton came to the door to awaken him. The night was clear, Slayton told him, and the weather at liftoff, set for 7:51 a.m., was expected to be good. Minutes later, after undergoing a final medical exam, Borman, Lovell, and Anders sat down to their last meal on Earth, the traditional astronaut's breakfast of steak and eggs. Deke Slayton was there, and Al Shepard, along with backup crewman Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, scientist astronaut Jack Schmidt, and the man who had envisioned this mission, George Lowe. Years later, Anders would remember the conversation as decidedly unremarkable, his mood as matter of fact. And if some of the support people seemed extra careful, extra serious, even a little nervous this morning, that was in striking contrast to the three of them who were about to leave the planet. When this brief, earthly ritual ended, the three men headed for the shooting room. There, technicians, wearing surgical masks as part of the pre-flight health quarantine, were waiting to help them into their spacesuits. Someday, suits like these would protect astronauts on the surface of the Moon, but on this flight they were merely a precaution against a loss of cabin pressure during launch. They were also fireproof, thanks to a pristine white covering of glass fiber beta cloth coated with Teflon. Hidden from view were layers of insulation and pressure restraints, special joints and cables to facilitate motion when the suit was pressurized, all of which made these suits seem less like garments than wearable machines. Each of the three astronauts, clad in long johns, climbed into his modern-day suit of armor. It was all familiar from tests and practice runs, but this morning the technicians had little tension breakers, a tiny stocking hanging from a paper Christmas tree for Frank Borman, a clean white handkerchief for the pocket of Jim Lovell's spacesuit. Next, the men donned communications hats resembling the headgear of a World War I flying ace. Oxygen hoses were mated to metallic blue and red connectors on the chest. Then came black rubber pressure gloves, joined to rotating rings at the wrists of the suit. Finally, a clear bubble helmet was lowered into place and snapped onto a metal neck ring. At that moment, each man was a self-contained universe. Aside from the occasional voice of a technician in their headsets, they heard only the sound of their own breathing. They felt cool oxygen flowing past their faces. For a time they rested, letting the pure oxygen purge their bloodstreams of nitrogen. Then, at last, it was time to go. Toting portable oxygen units, they headed down a long corridor to the outside with stiff-legged strides. At the entrance to the flight crew training building, they were greeted by the glare of television lights and a small crowd of well-wishers. Only a hint of applause penetrated their bubble helmets as they boarded a special transfer van for the 8-mile ride to Pad 39A. Brilliantly lit, the Saturn V stood naked next to its launch tower, its tanks full of cryogenic propellants, spewing plumes of vapor into the pre-dawn darkness. The sight of it filled Borman with awe. Accompanied by a suit technician, the three men entered into the service tower, and within that complex of steel girders, massive fuel pipes, and machinery, they boarded a small elevator and ascended past the Saturn's huge first stage, then the second and third stages to the 320-foot level. There they strode across an access arm to the small white room. First Borman, then Anders, climbed into the spacecraft, assisted by the closeout crew. Jim Lovell, meanwhile, waited alone for several minutes outside the crowded white room, within the metal gridwork of the access arm. From this lofty perch he gazed down at the most powerful rocket in existence, and all at once the realization came to him. My God, they're serious! That the very thing they had all been talking about and practicing for 4 months was about to happen. That NASA was really going to seal him up in that command module and fire him off to the moon. In the far distance, Lovell could see the headlights of cars making their way to viewing sites. Thousands of spectators had descended on the Cape, eager to witness the departure of the first moon voyagers. For a time, sealed within his private universe, Lovell savored this communion with awe. Then Lovell joined his crewmates, sliding on his back into the center couch. He lay still while the closeout crew hooked up oxygen hoses and communications lines. Strapped in, fully suited, he had almost no room to move. He was literally rubbing elbows with his crewmates. To his left, Borman lay before gauges and readouts for the Saturn V. He would keep a watchful eye on the booster's performance during the ascent into space. To Lovell's right, Anders manned the controls for the spacecraft's electrical and communication systems. From the center couch, Lovell would operate the command module's onboard computer and monitor their trajectory into space. At last, it was time to close the hatch. Rookie astronaut Fred Hayes, who had been inside the spacecraft checking switch positions when Borman's crew arrived, now wriggled underneath the couches and through the open hatchway, then offered his hand in farewell. The technicians swung the massive hatch closed and locked it, sealing the three astronauts inside. It was 5:34 a.m., T minus 2 hours, 17 minutes, and counting. Inside Apollo 8, all was quiet. Within their helmets, Borman's crew heard the voice of test conductor Dick Prophet talking to them from the launch control complex 3.5 miles away, where hundreds of engineers monitored data from the spacecraft and booster. For most of the next hour, they followed his instructions, setting switches, as part of the complex process of readying the command module for flight. Over in the right couch, Anders was amazed at how calm he felt. It was just like a simulation. He was almost bored. Around Pad 39A, the glare of floodlights yielded to a clear dawn. During a break in the switch settings, out of the corner of his eye, Anders noticed something moving. He looked over at a window in the protective heat shield, called the Boost Protective Cover, that covered the command module. A hornet buzzed around and landed, worked for a short while, then flew off and returned. She's building a nest, Anders thought, and did she pick the wrong place to build it? Far below, the great rocket was filling with fuel. If disaster threatened now, while the Saturn was still earthbound, the men would scurry out of their craft and into a small gondola attached to a slide wire stretching from the launch tower to a concrete bunker. And if there wasn't time for that, Bormann could, with the twist of a handle, fire the escape rocket poised above the command module's nose, whisking them up and away from the disaster. But an abort from the pad involved considerable risk of injury, and that was something everyone hoped would not be necessary. Meanwhile, 1,000 yards from the pad, armored tanks stood at the ready in case the men had to be rescued. Inside Apollo 8, Bormann asked Dick Prophet, "How is the booster doing?" Prophet assured him that all was well. Up to now, Bormann, Lovell, and Anders had known, in the back of their minds, that there was the possibility that a malfunction would turn this countdown into just another practice run, and they would have to climb out and try again another day. But now, as the count reached T-minus 15 minutes, there seemed no doubt. They were really going. In the control center, the flight surgeons monitoring telemetry from the spacecraft saw Bormann's heart rate start to climb. With 7 minutes left, Dick Prophet took his final status check, and in the middle of his lengthy poll he called out, "Spacecraft," and Bormann, Lovell, and Anders answered together in full voice, "Go!" Now the pace quickened. With just 5 minutes to go, the white room and its access arms swung away. At 3:07, the launch pad's automatic sequencer took over, monitoring the last influx of propellants and controlling the final events before liftoff. By T-60 seconds, all three stages were fully pressurized. 10 seconds after that, the booster went on its own power. With 45 seconds to go, Bormann confirmed the last switch settings to ready the command module for launch. 30 seconds. Now 20. And now test conductor Prophet began to count. 9, 8, 7. For a moment, the men heard faint sounds of fuel pouring through manifolds to the 5 huge F-1 engines. Ignition. Suddenly, the base of the Saturn spawned a cauldron of smoke and flame that gave way to a river of golden-white fire spilling out from both sides of the launch platform. Yellow smoke billowed into the chill morning. For long seconds, the behemoth strained against a set of enormous hold-down clamps while the first-stage engines built up to full power. Up in the command module, there was no noise or vibration, but somehow Bormann and his crew could sense the growing power far beneath them. At T-minus 3 seconds, there came a distant rumbling, like thunder on the horizon, that swelled into a roar. Finally, in the midst of the heightening commotion, came a sudden, mild jolt, and Bormann's crew heard Prophet cry, "Liftoff!" Bormann glanced at the mission clock on the instrument panel. "Liftoff," he called, his voice charged with adrenaline. "The clock is running." The Saturn ascended, seemingly racked by spasms of uncertainty, steering nervously past the launch tower, its engines correcting and recorrecting in quick, spasmodic jerks. Up in the command module, these corrections translated into sudden, jarring motions that threw the men from side to side against their harnesses.